The Tom Woods Show, episode 2389.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Welcome to episode 2389 with Wanjiru Njoya, who is back with us for a second time. She's originally from Kenya, attended the University of Nairobi. She's a senior lecturer at the University of Exeter Law School in the UK. Is that still, am I still getting that right?
That's right, yes.
And you've taught at numerous other places, St. John's College, Oxford, London School of Economics, etc. And you're, of course, published the way an academic would be published, but I think the publications that people enjoy the most are maybe your tweets, which is true of so many of us. I reserve some of my punchiest material for Twitter, which I'm sorry, I am too old school. I don't know if I'm ever going to call it X. In my heart, it'll always be Twitter to me. So anyway, so I thought we'd talk about some of the sort of controversial themes that you've been raising in your feed lately. But in order to do that, I think I'd like to ask you some personal questions about your upbringing and your background, if you don't mind.
Well, let's see. Have a go, see what the questions are.
Well, I mean, what I mainly want to know is, you have, let's say, opinions that other people, I've seen this happen to you on Twitter, other people will say, how can you have opinions like this? So you come from Africa. And as far as I understand, all Africans think the same way. So what's your problem? So I'd like to know, first of all, if all Africans do think the same way, but also what it is, like what it was in your background and your upbringing that may have made you have the capacity for dissident thought that people just don't expect from you for some reason.
I don't even think it's an African thing. I think it's to do with being Black, because all Black people get that. Black Americans get the same thing. And so there's this idea that, in fact, there have been debates about this on Twitter about whether Black people are a monolith. People say, oh, Black people aren't a monolith. We're individual. We think, each of us thinks for ourselves. Whether there's such a thing as the Black hive mind. Do all Black people think the same way? So there have been debates about that. So it's not necessarily just about being African. And I think there just seems to be a sense that it's to do with this idea that white people are privileged and Black people are oppressed. And that if you're oppressed, there are certain opinions you're expected to have in keeping with your oppressed status. You may have seen those memes going around where there's a Black person saying, I'm not oppressed. And then there's a white liberal saying, yeah, you are, because you're Black, you're supposed to be oppressed. So I think that's what it's about more than so much being African, because I get that even from people who don't know that I'm from Africa. I don't think in Africa my views, I mean, there are dissidents in Africa, of course, who take a similar line to the one that I take, even in countries that, so I've talked a lot about South Africa where they have significant white minority, but it's the same even in countries that only have Black people in. You get some people who want to follow a socialist line and other people who think, no, we should think more about individual rights, private property. So you see this even in African countries.
What was it that made you decide to go to the UK? And I mean, I suppose maybe you have gone back and visited home during this time, but you've made your permanent residence in the UK.
I came here as a graduate student. I came to the UK as a graduate student. So I did my first law degree in Nairobi at the University of Nairobi and came to England for graduate law studies, which is the obvious place for Kenyans to go for law studies because it's the same legal system, the common law legal system. So it's, I would say it's pretty similar to the American legal system or the Canadian legal system or any common law system, but it's closer. England's the most obvious place. So that's why I came. And then I spent some years as a Rhodes Scholar. And here I still am. And it was never my intention. I guess I must be one of those immigrants they're all complaining about now. That
I can't imagine anybody complaining. Anybody with anybody with two brain cells to rub together would not be complaining about you, it seems to me. But anyway, so you have been there for how long in England?
Oh, so I came to start my PhD in 1998, so getting on for years now.
Okay. So how have things evolved or changed for better or worse in terms of what we now call wokeism? How have you observed it during your own time there?
Wow. So it's very personal, I think, for many people. But for me, the first time I paid really attention to it, I always just ignored it because my areas of law were nothing to do with wokery. It was property law and contracts and things like this. So I never paid attention. I saw it in the news, but I did pay any attention until they started with the Black Lives Matter business and telling people to kneel down to show, I don't know, whatever it was people were supposed to show. And I thought, no. And that's when I started to realize that it's actually a problem to just say no, because all the arguments surround the people who've been pushing this woke narrative. They've got all the arguments, and the people who've been ignoring them have no arguments, because why would you if you're ignoring the whole thing? And that's when I realized, wow, it's such a problem. We've got to think a little bit more carefully than we perhaps thought we might have to about what's going on and how we can respond to it. We're no longer in a situation where we can just laugh at them and ignore them and say, oh, look at them being woke, and just carry on with our lives, because they are changing the law and legal obligations. And so we can't just ignore it. So that's what got me interested in it, was thinking about what the arguments are and how we can respond to them.
Why aren't you moved by the arguments? And the arguments, if I may express them as strongly as I can and as sympathetically as I can, would be that despite the merits of the Western world, and they would never put it that way, but despite the merits of the Western world, there is nevertheless a history of racial injustice that has taken place toward non-whites. And because of that history of injustice, that puts non-whites at a disadvantage even today. Even though nobody alive today directly perpetrated these injustices on them, those people nevertheless inherit the legacy of that. And the injustices are likewise a legacy for non-whites. And there is no non-clunky way to resolve this problem. So we have to do it a clunky way, which is take from some people and give to others, whether that's wealth or opportunities or whatever. Why are you unmoved by that?
I'm so impressed, Tom. You've done your best to give this argument,
I tried,
you know, the best sort of spin that one could give. It rests on premises that are false. If they state that this is the problem and now we have to think about how to fix it, then it sounds like there's a plausible debate to be had there, because we're just debating how to respond to it. But think about the premise, your starting point, where you say Black people have been oppressed. I mean, that's only true if you ignore literally all of history, except for the cherry-picked oppression points that you want to highlight, which is a ridiculous way to understand history. I mean, if you look at the history of, for example, Africa, I'll take that example because that's where I'm from. If you take the history of Africa and what's been going on there for centuries, like slavery. Okay, so Africans were enslaving other Africans for hundreds of years before the Europeans got involved in the trade. They thought, oh, here's a trade we could get involved in and we can just turbocharge it and make even more money than the Africans are making from it. But this trade hadn't been ongoing. So if you say, well, we're suffering injustice because of what the Europeans did, that's a very blinkered way of looking at the problem, because slavery had been ongoing long before the Europeans came. And it continued long after they left. It's still continuing to this day. So why would you just take a tiny little sliver of history, the one where there were colonies, and then say, that's how we're going to understand the world? That's the problem that I've got with this. And even if you look at people being poor, so people say, well, now we have legacies because we're all poor. And the reason we're poor is because of the legacies of oppression. But if you look at the reasons for poverty, if you are illiterate, right? So we were just debating the South African statistics where over 80% of children are illiterate. If you're over 80% illiterate, and I know it's the same in some cities in the United States with Black communities, if you have 90% illiteracy that they have in some cities, I don't even understand why you would be looking beyond that for a cause or why you're not getting along. You aren't going to make progress when you cannot read or write. They're functionally illiterate. They can't do basic math. You aren't really going to make any economic progress. And the idea that you would say, I need to look for explanations outside of this seems to me ludicrous. And that's just one example that I've picked with illiteracy. There are so many other examples.
But also you could spend your time renaming the school, because the school has the name of a bad oppressor. So we'll rename the school. Nothing else will change about the school.
Yeah.
But the name of the school will be changed.
Yeah. And also, oh, look, but what are we teaching in history? It doesn't matter what you're teaching in history. The children can't read. Teach them how to read. So they're never worried about fixing problems. So to me, it's such a stretch to say we have legacies of oppression. First, learn how to read and write. That's such a basic thing. And you never hear parents saying we want our children to be taught how to read. Instead, they're marching, saying, here's how we want slavery to be taught. How's that going to help the children learning about slavery this way and that way? You can teach your children slavery at home if you feel that's a really important thing you want them to learn. And they should go to school, learn how to read, write, do math.
So in the United States, I'm sure it's quite similar in the UK, but in the United States, I would say that if I had to summarize what wokeism is about, there are probably maybe three or four, I don't know if we'd call them principles, but one of them would be that if there are differences in outcomes, there is always a sinister explanation for them.
Yeah,
I would say that's, if not the only principle of wokeism, it's central to it. So what's a response to that? Because of course, on the surface, you would think, well, you have these two groups and one group doesn't do as well educationally or with income or whatever, or even health outcomes sometimes. Well, what other explanation could there be? If a whole bunch of people whose last names began with the letter Q all had this same thing in common, they were all doing poorly, or let's say more poorly than others, then I might want to look into, well, are people maybe giving people with the last name beginning with Q a hard time? That would be my first instinct.
Maybe this goes back to what you asked me in the beginning, why I don't find these arguments remotely persuasive. To me, taking something, so I grew up in a very, very poor part of a very poor country where everybody's poor and everybody learned how to read and write. You don't even need a huge amount of resources to learn how to read and write. You don't need fancy buildings and sports facilities. You just need somebody prepared to sit with you and teach you how to read. There's a picture I like. If anyone's seen on my Twitter, they may have seen a picture of David Livingstone sitting on the floor with his African servants and he's reading to them from the Bible. You don't need a huge industrial complex to learn how to read and write. So I find it implausible when people say, we need a complex explanation for why these oppressed people can't learn how to read and write. No, their parents are not teaching them. Doesn't matter how bad the school is, teach your children how to read. In terms of looking, why do they look for complicated explanations? They say, oh, it must be discrimination and it must be legacies of oppression and legacies of this and that. Why? Why do they look for these complex explanations? I think, and here I want to try and be a little bit sympathetic, if I can. I think there's a lot of fear and pain and egos get involved and people start feeling, oh, we don't want to explore the reasons. Oh, and then they're afraid people are going to start saying it's your genetics, it's your IQ. And, you know, you people, you've got a low IQ. And they're trying to kind of avoid any questions like that by saying it's nothing to do with that, it's to do with discrimination. I find that implausible because we're not even asking much. We're not saying, to take your question, Tom, if you were to say to me, why do we have such a small percentage becoming brain surgeons? Why do we have such a small percentage becoming nuclear physicists? If it was those types of questions, I would say, well, yes, actually, this could be interesting for us to look for the reasons. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about basic things like getting a high school diploma and getting a job and putting food on your family's table. And I don't think you need complex explanations for those failures or for why people. Oh, yeah, there was this other one where they were saying people steal. They run into all these designer shops and steal power tools because they're hungry and that's because they want to eat. That's not plausible.
Yeah.
Nobody steals to that level because they want to eat. So we're looking for all these complex explanations for very simple problems.
I remember years ago when I used to teach, I was on a panel. And I, of course, I'm the only person on the panel who is thinking sensibly. And we were talking about issues like this. And somebody on the panel said something like, well, of course, rich white students can afford to take test prep courses, like for the SAT, let's say. Now, I never took a test. Anybody taking a test prep course had an advantage over me of any race. Didn't even dawn on me to do that. But I understand why some people might want to do that. And they're saying, yeah, they have that advantage. Now, the number of people taking test prep courses, I would assume, is vanishingly small. That it's only kids who almost always didn't need to take the test prep anyway. But somebody in the audience said, well, couldn't you just go to the library and take out a test prep book? And then the room went silent, because that is the obvious answer. If you go to the library and take out a test prep book, you have an advantage over me because I'm a lazy bum who didn't do it. If you want it, it's right there waiting for you. If you want that, you can have it.
Yes.
But if you're living in a society that babies you and coddles you and treats you like you're seven, you're going to act like you're seven. That's my theory.
It's absolutely incredible the excuses people will come up with for the simplest of things. One example that I've shared a lot is a photograph from people complaining in South Africa because they've got these outdoor toilets with no walls and no roof. And they're complaining and they're saying the government, it's racism, it's the apartheid, and the government hasn't built some walls. And I just think, how difficult is it to construct two walls and a roof?
Right.
I mean, even otters in the river are able to make their little homes and they haven't even studied anything. It's not rocket science.
There's a very funny video here in the US that has to do with the subject of the requirements for voting, that you need to be able to show picture ID when you vote. And of course, this is described as racist. And you think, well, what would be racist about that? And so somebody made a video interviewing white liberals. But do you think it's racist that you have to show picture ID to vote? And they say, oh, yes, I do, because they know that they're supposed to say that, even though it's a dumb thing to say. Why do you think it's racist? Well, black people, you know, they can't, like, well, they can't what? Well, they, you know, they have to go to the DMV and get an ID. And so then they interview black people living in Harlem and they say, do you have picture ID? And they say, of course I do. And they say, well, if you needed to get picture ID again, would you know where to go? And they're all saying, yeah, the DMV, it's right down there. And they say, like, do you know that there are white people who think you're too dumb to do that? And they say, really? It's just such a great video.
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous. I mean, even if you don't know how to do things, you can just go and ask.
Yeah, I know. I know. You can just ask.
It's difficult to think of what kind of person you'd have to be who can't do things. I mean, these days, even building things, it's so easy to build anything if you go on YouTube and write how to build a wall, you know, and it'll tell you for free how to do stuff. So the idea that we need these complicated systemic explanations for why people don't do basic things, it strikes me as ludicrous.
Now, of course, this won't happen, but if the alleged black leadership in the US weren't simply in it for money and influence, they would abandon politics and they would go into some of these rundown neighborhoods and they would say, look, we need to live with some dignity and we are perfectly capable of living with dignity and cleaning up where we live and living in a way that is a good example for our children so we can break out of this cycle. And I realize that we're not supposed to have these conversations in public because this embarrasses us in front of white people, but I am willing to suffer the embarrassment in exchange for having a thriving neighborhood here. Now, who's with me? And let the builders build. Find the builders and let them build. No one even considers this. No one even considers this. And it's the most obvious thing in the world. But I want to ask you, though, about the South Africa situation, because you've been writing about it. I think most people in the US don't know anything about what's going on at all. At the same time, I just the other day saw a YouTube video, I think it had about 150,000 views, in which a black commentator said, whites in the West who think there's a big crisis in South Africa, that we're killing all the Boers, they're just living in la-la land. You go there yourself, you see that is not happening. You have some hotheads, but that is not happening. The Boers are deceiving you about the real situation on the ground. As far as you know, what is actually going on?
Right. So it's a really difficult situation. And I have sympathy for the people who are saying, don't talk about it. You know, you're just going to make it worse. If people think we're this hellhole and everything's going to pot, that's going to precipitate even further decline. Let's try and at least maintain a facade of things working. And there are people in industries that are dependent on this, like tourism. And people, somebody was writing about this on Twitter as well, about having contracts with international companies, not wanting to spook them if they hear that, oh, well, you know what's going on. We don't want to encourage this, so we don't want to deal. So I have some sympathy with that. There's a strong urge not to make the situation worse, if I can put it that way, by talking about it and creating more heat than is necessary. So that's part of it. And I can sort of sympathize with that. But here's the problem, is these farmers on their farms, basically under attack and reporting the attacks and reporting they're basically being killed and being told, here's your crime number, go and wait for the police to show up, being brushed aside as if it doesn't matter. Honestly, to me, that's almost the worst aspect of it. This idea that you can be going through this and everyone's trying to shush you and to tell you not to talk about it. Do you just go home and call the police and wait, we'll investigate, which they don't. And they'll never hear anything. You hear some of them reporting, no one's been arrested, nothing's happened. And they are basically under attack and they've been left to look after their own security as best they can. So they're literally just calling each other, calling their neighbors when they're attacked. And so there was a case the other day where their neighboring farmers just came running to try and help. They've basically been just left to it. Now, this was featured some years ago. It was 2012, actually. It was featured in the British press. And they asked the South African police, what's going on? Why aren't you saying anything or doing anything about the murders of white farmers? And they said, well, we can't categorize white farmers as victims of crime. We just have to count crime as crime, and we can't categorize according to race. Because if we do that, it will give the impression that white farmers are special. In fact, they said we can't look at them as the special golden boys and girls. If we start saying X number of white farmers were attacked, people will say, oh, why are you counting them? Are they special? So the politics of it gets in as well, and they downplay the numbers of attacks. But to me, the most important issue is the people on the ground facing those attacks. And that, to me, is the reason why it's wrong to try and silence them and to tell them not to talk about it. Their lives are at stake.
Can you talk about this Kill the Boer song?
So they're trying to, as you saw, you may have seen the video that was everywhere because the New York Times talked about it and the Washington Post, and it was this political rally and they were all chanting and saying Kill the Boer. And
well, I don't mean to interrupt, but when you say they, can we be super specific? Who are we talking about?
Whenever people ask me on Twitter, I say the commies, because it's the EFF, okay, the Economic Freedom Fighters, who are a political party. So they're the ones who had the rally. So when we say they and, you know, all the court cases, that's who's involved. It's a political party that, well, they're just doing politics like any political party, and they're chanting Kill the Boer, and they're saying that that's their chant to show the struggle. And they say the struggle is ongoing because it's a struggle for land. They're saying we want our land, you know, and they tell white farmers to go back to Europe. As they're not from Europe, they're African. So that's who it is. But the reason why I'm just saying they is because the ruling party, the ANC, are their comrades. There's this whole thing of it's all the black people in it together. So you can draw distinctions. You can say that there are distinctions between the different political parties, but they're all comrades and they're all saying we want our land. And that is what is driving the attacks on farms because of this. And this is what's so wrong about this, is creating this political environment where they're saying these farmers should not be on these farms, and creating the sense that you are justified if you attack them, because after all, they call it stolen land. So they're saying they shouldn't be on those farms. And that sort of creates an atmosphere where people feel that in attacking them, they are justified because they're just trying to seize what is rightfully theirs. And that's why it's wrong. And that's what they've been saying all along, that it's not just about crime, because that's what they try and say, oh, it's just crime. It's a high crime society and these are criminals. It's not just the criminals. It's the fact that the political environment is encouraging them, saying, you go get yours.
Well, not to mention, you mentioned major newspapers in the West.
Yeah.
And the way they've covered this matter of this song is way more sympathetic than they would have been if any other group had sung a similar song. Oh, this is an old protest song. It doesn't mean what it obviously does mean. It's a song about killing people, but not really. It's just a struggle song. I guarantee you, if we're talking any other society, any other situation, singing kill the so-and-so, the New York Times would take that literally.
And they're saying that, oh, it's only white supremacists who are concerned if you kill white people. No, it's not. Killing people is wrong. You know, what has shocked me so much about this, Tom, is that I've had to explain to people that killing other people is wrong because they have arguments. They're like, no, it's white farmers and they stole the land. Well, you can't just kill them.
But what are the rights and wrongs of that accusation?
Of saying they stole the land?
Yes.
Well, they've been there almost 400 years. And when they arrived on the lands that are their lands, there was nothing there, just grassland, scrubland. In fact, there was nothing there. There were no farms. They've literally created those farms out of land. The vast majority of their land is not even natural farming land. They've had to coax that land to yield crops, and they have cattle and been farming for generations. They didn't steal the land. They homesteaded the land, as anybody is entitled to do.
I'm sorry for knowing so little about the situation in South Africa. So I don't know if there was a land reform movement or anything like that. But I have this quotation that you shared on your Twitter feed that I wonder if you could help explain to somebody like me who doesn't really know the background. And the quotation is, about 90% of the redistributed farms, and that's what I don't know, is what is the redistributed farms, have failed, leaving idle nearly 15 million acres of once productive farmland, about 6% of South Africa's arable land. What's that a reference to?
So they've had all these truth and reconciliation processes where they say, we have to start afresh. So after the end of apartheid, and they're saying, we have to start afresh. We have to all be friends and get together. So they have had some land reform processes. In fact, I posted on there the link to the article that explains all of it, because I know it's very contested. So they came to an agreement that I think it was 30% of the farms, because let's remember, it's not just land they want, it's the farms. They're not just saying we want land. They're saying we want the farms that the white farmers are farming. We want the white farmer gone and we want the farm. So they came to some agreement that they would redistribute 30% of those, to which they have made some effort. In fact, that article that I posted there says they've redistributed about 24% of the farms. And they gave them an option to either have the farm or money in lieu of the farm, of which 90% of them said, yeah, I'll take the money. So much for their intentions to farm. And then there are some who took over the farms, and those are the farms that I was referring to there that are now derelict, abandoned.
And should I ask the forbidden question?
Go on.
What happened to them?
To the farms?
Yes. Like, why are they not functioning? Were the new owners not really that good at it after all?
And also not interested in being good at it, I think. Farming is hard work.
Yeah. So do you think maybe this is more about the struggle than the outcome? I want to struggle, but then they give it to me and I don't want to get up at 4:30 in the morning and to do this work.
Farms are hard work and they don't want to work hard. Tom, if they wanted to work hard, they wouldn't be in the position they're in, right?
No, they would not.
Because hard work yields fruit. If you work hard, you get, you know, you won't languish in poverty forever. It may take you a while, but you'll get there. You work hard and your children will work hard, which is exactly what the Boers did. They worked hard and now look, they have farms. So they don't want to do the work. And there's been a lot of frustration because I know I've debated with some of these people. They're saying, I don't want anyone to tell me how to farm. I got my own ideas about how I'm going to do this. Let's give equal opportunities to all the weeds. And then the farm is overgrown by weeds. So there's an unwillingness. There's a farcical unwillingness to learn. Farm animals being abandoned. There have been court cases about this. There was one farm worker saying, I abandoned the animals because I had to feed them and I had no food, and so I left. Well, what do you expect the farm animals to do? They just starve to death. So it's a failure. It's a failure like the one we were discussing earlier, which is a very basic failure of very basic common sense things that are not happening. Oh, and then one of the farmers who was charged with animal cruelty for neglecting her animals, which all died. She said, oh, I'm being prosecuted because it's racism.
Ludwig von Mises, in his book, Liberalism, speaks with extreme moral indignation about European colonialism. Now, obviously, European colonialism is not one single thing. There are numerous societies interacting with numerous other societies. What is your assessment of it?
Of colonialism?
Yes. I mean, I'm putting you on the hot seat here. What fun would the Tom Woods show be without that?
My understanding of Mises's objection to it is an objection to imperialism in general. Just this idea of conquest, where you decide, you know, it's an act of aggression. So you think, oh, you know, I want some land and I want an empire. I'm going to empire build. And I'm just going to set sail and find people and conquer them. That's what he has an objection to, which I share. I mean, behaving in that aggressive way is wrong. It's like being a schoolyard bully and saying, I want everything for myself and I want to be the king of all I survey. That aspect of it, that imperialistic aspect of it is wrong. But colonialism is not just about that, about conquest. It's also about many other things like trade, commerce. At the time, Christianity, what they called civilization, teaching people how to read and write. And so there was much more to it than just conquest. And those aspects of it had a lot of good in them. It is never good to conquer people, but it's good to teach people to read and write, of course. Who would say that that's a bad thing? It's good to teach people about health. It's good to introduce new farming practices. It's good to introduce private property. These are good things. And I don't understand people who say that these are bad things. They're not. They're absolutely inherently good things to do. So that's my view of colonialism. It had some aggressive aspects to it, but also it had some benefits to it. And even the aggression, if I can just add this, was not always about conquest. Let me go and find people to dominate. Sometimes it was about security. The early British territories were called protectorates for exactly that reason. We go and protect people. And let's remember, I just have to get this in there, there were some native tribes who asked for protection from the British because their neighboring tribes were slaughtering them. And the British had superior arms. So they said, can you come and keep us safe from our neighboring tribes? And the British said, sure, because they felt it was their, well, you know what they were like. They felt it was the white man's burden to go out there and keep everybody safe. So they did it. So it wasn't all just about dominating and what people say today that it was about exploitation. There is exploitation to it, but that's not the whole story.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Monetary Metals. Well, you may have heard that Jeff Deist is no longer the president of the Mises Institute. Where is Jeff? He is at a company called Monetary Metals, a company I myself have been using for one or two years by now. The idea of it is this. A lot of us know where the dollar is going, and so we hold some gold. But how do we hold that gold? Well, typically by putting it in a box somewhere or hiding it in the house or whatever. But the point is it just sits there. Well, what if instead of just sitting there, you could get it to generate interest for you? Well, you can grow your gold year after year with Monetary Metals, which offers interest on gold paid in more ounces of physical gold. You can earn 2 to 4% on gold and silver in their leasing program, which supports qualified gold-using businesses. And if you're an accredited investor, you can earn higher returns, think double digits, in their gold bond offerings. All the interest is paid in physical ounces of gold, as I say, so your total ounces grow and compound year over year. So over a 10-year period, 2.5% annual, 100 ounces becomes 128, 3%, 100 ounces becomes 134, 4 ounces, 100 ounces becomes 148 ounces. You get the idea. They've been at this for 7 years now. As I said, Jeff Deist recently joined forces with them. Their vice president of relationships, Addison Quayle, has been a guest in my home. He's been a guest on the Tom Woods Show. I've seen him for years and years at all kinds of libertarian conferences. He's a great guy, and he's one of us. These are people doing something really, really creative and important. So start saving and earning in gold. Go to monetarymetals.com/woods to learn more about how to get started with your account. That's monetarymetals.com/woods. A couple more things I want to hit on. You have mentioned in your feed something that I didn't know about, and I follow these things, I thought, pretty closely. And that is that there are actually now such things as departments of hate studies. You know, there is absolutely no chance you're going to have an impartial, rational conversation with anybody in any of these. That's one thing. And then the other thing is you've been talking about the rise of proposals for hate speech laws in various countries. Can you comment on both of these things and how concerned we should be?
Yeah, the two things are linked because, well, let me start with the hate speech laws, because many different jurisdictions have said we want to introduce hate speech laws. And for jurisdictions that already have that, they're starting to say we want people jailed, which I think is an even more serious problem. Mm. We want people jailed for hate speech. So that's got a lot of press because I think people can see the danger in that and they can see the double standards in the way that these types of laws are applied. So that's been debated a lot. And to my mind, that's in fact less of a worry because people are alert to that danger. Most people are alert to that danger. But here's where it becomes even more concerning, is where you get people opposing hate speech laws but saying, we need to know how hate would be defined. We need to know the meaning of hate before we agree to this. So it's almost like there's a danger that they will agree to it if they think, you know, it's been carefully defined. So it's very similar to the debates people have about euthanasia, for example, where they say we don't want the idea of the government encouraging people to kill themselves, but if there are strict safeguards, then yes, we can see that. So it's a very similar debate where they're saying if we can define hate, we will agree to these hate speech laws. Now, here's the point I was making. There are actually people who consider themselves experts in hate. So they say, well, you know, I'm the expert in hate. I will tell you what hate is because I have a PhD in hate. That, you know, I've been studying hate for all these years. What do you know about hate? Nothing. So, you know, leave it to the experts. And these experts in hate studies are, as you would expect, it's critical race theories. They're learning about the oppressed people and now they're suffering from hate. And how, linking back to our earlier discussion, saying kill the Boer is not hate. That's just a struggle song. But if you ask a Black person, and where are you from? Oh, that's hate, because it's a microaggression which shows how hateful you are. Those are the kinds of things that the hate experts will say. So that's the danger in them. It sounds like social studies and people laugh at them. They say, oh, that, well, that's really funny and ridiculous. It isn't a joke because these are the people who say I'm the expert in hate. And they get called to give expert evidence on what hate means. And we are all going to be subject to the rule of these experts. And when people are sent for re-education to learn all about hate, those are the people who will be re-educating you.
Yeah.
You're like, sit down and listen to my lessons in hate.
But the thing is, I think people like this have figured out that the average person does not want to be accused of hate.
Yes.
And will go to some lengths.
Yeah.
To try to exonerate himself even before the accusation. Oh, I agree with you. Hate is a big problem. And they exploit that natural tendency of people not to want to be thought of as haters.
Yes.
To then demand, well, then surely you're not going to mind if we just make sure people don't use this or that word.
Yes.
And they'll agree to that. And then before you know it, it's not this or that word. It's entire, well, these ideas lead people to say those kinds of words. So now you can't express those ideas.
It's exactly that. You touched on it exactly. We all know hate is a bad thing. And it's exactly the same con behind words like equality and justice. Everybody wants those things. So if they say this is for equality, everybody says, oh, I'm up for that. As long as you define it in a way that I think is okay, I'm going to support that. It's exactly the same with hate. Nobody likes hate, clearly. And that's why it's so dangerous. You get people saying, I don't care if they jail people for hate because I know I'm not a hateful person, so it's not going to happen to me.
But what is the big danger then? I mean, is there really a danger that this would go beyond people who are genuinely inciting people to violence out of hatred for people unlike themselves? Are we genuinely concerned that it could mean that I could be accused of hate because I wrote a paper that they didn't like?
It's already happened to so many people. It's already happened to so many people. That's what's been driving cancel culture, is people saying, you wrote about it. So it's happened to people, for example, writing about colonialism, saying there are benefits to colonialism. They've been accused of hate. Like, you're trying to say that people need to be colonized because you hate them. So it's happened to people, even in the most obscure fields. It happened to some academic in music theory, the theory of music, because he wrote about a musician, a theoretical musician who turned out apparently to have friends. This was in 1930s Germany. So they said, oh, look, this theorist that you're writing about, this composer theorist that you're writing about, had friends in Nazi Germany, therefore music theory, the whole field is a hate field, it's full of hate. And you can get all the experts to say that, yes, we can certify that that's hateful. So it's real, it's been happening to people. And the other thing that's been happening is people being unable to express their culture. This happened, again, to give a South African example with the flag. They said the flag is hate speech, the old South African flag. It's hate speech. Now you can't display the flag. Well, so people like displaying that flag. It means a lot to them. And now being told, well, you're displaying it because you're hateful. So these are real things that are already affecting people's lives. And that's the danger. People losing their jobs, losing their livelihoods, people having their bank accounts closed because they've been saying things that are deemed to be hateful. It has implications for everything that you've seen going on under cancel culture.
The thing is, though, as I'm sure you realize, people arguing for this have a rhetorical advantage because
Yes. It
makes us have to defend people who obviously shouldn't be in prison, but are not the world's most pleasant people in the world, right? So now I have to be perceived as more or less being in league with them, even though I'm just saying I think in society we ought to be able to say what we want to say. So it seems like if you are going to argue against this, you cannot get in the trap of, now I have to defend every crazy thing every lunatic in the world has ever said, but rather point to examples of people who, to a reasonable person, are not really any danger to anybody and say these people are being victimized. And that's exactly where this type of thing is going to go. And in our society, this is something our ancestors fought for to make sure we would have. And that the way we try to reach the truth, it's not perfect, but it's the only way we know how, is to have robust discussion. And because I don't trust, the last people on earth I would trust are politicians to decide what are the acceptable ideas and what aren't. Because, today they say this idea that you don't like is unacceptable, and you say, well, that sounds fine. But what are they going to say tomorrow? What are they going to say when it's the opposite party in power? What are they going to define as hate? Instead of going through this labyrinth of mutual oppression, how about we just drop all this and act like normal people who just talk, and some people who say things we don't like, we shun them, we ignore them, we just move on with our lives, and other people we do like, we subscribe to their newsletter, whatever it is. I mean, I would try to argue it like that instead of letting them paint me into a corner I can probably never get out of.
Why would you be in a corner you can't get out of? I would defend, and I think we had great success with that strategy in England compared to many other countries. We defended statues of slavers. We never had that thing where we say, oh, that one's a slaver, you can topple him. That one was a good guy, we keep that statue. No, we defended all of them, including Edward Colston, who was a slaver. It wasn't like David Livingston, whose statue was also threatened, or Edmund Burke, they brought down his bust. It wasn't like those good people that are easy to defend, where you say, oh, but you know, David Livingston was a missionary, Edmund Burke was a father of conservatism, William Gladstone, those are the easy people to defend. But if you only defend the people whose views you feel you can align with, you end up with what we've seen in North America, which is statues being crushed to dust. And that hasn't happened here. And I think it's because we've defended all the statues, including the statues of slavers. So to give the example of Edward Colston, who was a slave trader, and they toppled his statue, tipped it into the harbor, and people defended him. And they said, you cannot just destroy statues because you don't like history. And I think that helped a lot, because then they tried to take down Winston Churchill, and they tried to dig up some things he said that were, they said, oh, look at this thing he said that was a racist thing. And we defended him. You have to defend all the statues or you lose them all. And I think you've seen that in the States. You've seen, wasn't there this memorial of a horse, General Lee's horse?
Yeah.
They took down the statue of the general, then they took down the statue of his horse. What had his horse done? Nothing. So you have to defend everyone or you end up losing even the good people because the...
Yeah, I agree. I have nothing against defending everyone in the sense that I don't want to see anybody silenced. But I'm not going to be put into a corner where I'm going to let them give me, here are eight things this person said, and I want to hear your response. It's none of my business. I didn't say any of those things. I'm not responsible for any of that. What I mean is, I don't want to get into the weeds of every single individual person.
Yeah.
I just want to say, in general, I don't want anybody silenced. And yeah, maybe I don't agree with what that guy said, and I'm not going to sit here allowing you to put me on the defensive. Like, the presumption is that this person should be silenced, and I have to defend the merits of what he's saying.
Yeah.
The presumption is he should be allowed to speak, and it doesn't matter what the merits are of what he's saying.
Yeah, because then it gets stupid. They call it grievance mining. They can dig up anybody's... I mean, when they took down... Who was it? One of the Scottish Enlightenment... Hume. When they took down David Hume, that's because they dug up this footnote he had in one of his essays where he had written something problematic. That's how deep they will tunnel to look for things that people have said and say, oh, look at this thing this person said. Do you agree with that? Well, that's not the point. And I also think, and I also say this to people, that it's playing into their scheme and their trap if you start out by saying, I don't agree with it. So to take the example of slavery, if I was saying that it's wrong to topple the statue of Edward Colston, I won't say, well, slavery is wrong, but...
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that. Yeah, no, I'm sick of that. Yeah. One of the problems with the left is how absolutely out to lunch it is. Now, maybe some of them are smart and just trying to look stupid, but they act like there are a lot of people today who still favor slavery. And so the idea that I should have to say, look, I'm against slavery. Everybody in 2023 is against slavery. So you're not going to manipulate me into saying that. And incidentally, a point that I've made along these lines is, if you're going to talk all day long about how against slavery you are in 2023, I highly doubt in 1850 you would have gone out saying you're against slavery.
Exactly.
Because in 1850, it would have required sacrifice, and you would have maybe been killed, you would have lost friends, you would have lost wealth.
Yeah.
When there's actually something at stake, you can forget it from these people. Forget it. Not a word. Maybe they would be bold and cheeky and write an article about how slavery needs to be phased out in 75 years. We would have gotten that from these people. These are the last people on earth who would have, and here in particular, I mean the conservatives and libertarians who go out of their way to explain that they're not like Tom Woods, because I have a funny feeling he secretly favors slavery. I am far superior to him. Yeah. In 1850, I think I know which one of us actually would have been fighting against it. The one of us
exactly.
who isn't afraid to be unpopular.
Exactly so.
So.
Exactly so. And it's so demeaning, isn't it, to make people denounce things that nobody holds to.
Nobody holds. I know. It's totally crazy. All right, look, people have to follow you on Twitter. I wrote a whole issue of my newsletter about you and your Twitter feed. I didn't even know. Usually, sometimes Lou Rockwell runs occasional issues of my newsletter. He'll usually ask me, is it okay if I run this one? And there's almost never any reason to say no, but he didn't ask me this time. I just woke up and I had the lead article for the weekend, LouRockwell.com. And it was my article all about you. And all I had done was tell people who you were, give them your academic credentials. And then I just included a sampling of things you'd been tweeting. And I got emails this weekend, they should have been directed to you, saying, wow, what a great person you'd found for us. I'm definitely going to follow her. So I hope people will do that. You have
Thank you for sending them my way. I like it on Twitter because I can put the articles and links for people to check, you know, all these kind of fact checkers, and they can go follow it up if they want to see what it's all about. So thanks for sending them my way.
Oh, absolutely delighted to do so. And since I do have a video version of the Tom Woods Show now, for people who are watching it, they can see your name right on the screen and not have to figure out the spelling. It's just at your name, Wanjiro Njoya, and then you can follow you on Twitter. But I'll also put that on the show notes page. Let's see, that's tomwoods.com/2389. Well, I appreciate you following me on this rather circuitous episode, but just so many things to talk about with you, and I appreciate the things you're doing very much. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Tom, for having me on. I appreciate that.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.